Good evening, everyone. Thanks for joining us. We're going to go ahead and get started. Sorry we're a little late. I hear the parking is a little crazy tonight, so I'm sure people will continue to come in. It's very casual here. We have food, of course, drinks, so feel free to help yourself. And we'll go ahead and get started. My name is Lori Strauss. I'm the executive director for the Atlanta Press Club, and we appreciate your coming here this evening. We have a great group of panelists here tonight that I know they're going to have a lot of insight, especially, you know, after Super Tuesday and with Romney's announcement today, so I know we're going to have a very lively conversation. First of all, I want to introduce our moderator for the evening, Walter Jones. Walter is a political reporter and news analyst for Morris News Service. A Griffin native, Walter has been covering Georgia politics in Atlanta since 1998. He's an observer of state and national politics he's been an observer of state and national politics long before that. Walter writes a weekly column of news analysis on Georgia politics. Often he's been the first to report controversies like the Photo ID Voting Act and Republican plans for a gasoline tax holiday. Please welcome Walter.
Thank you, Lauren. I appreciate that. This is sort of like church. I see the people tend to sit in the back instead of up here in the front, but it's kind of an intimate evening tonight, so we'll keep it casual so we can have a good conversation. In addition to that introduction, I should tell you that I'm not completely a newspaper troglodyte. I was involved and wrote about kind of the social implications of computerization and the use of personal computers as far back as the early 1980s. So I have an interest in some of this stuff, even though it's not evident in my daily job, I guess. Let me tell you who our panelists are. We have first up, on your closest to me, Tom Baxter. Tom, for over 40 years, worked for newspapers in Montgomery, Columbia, Maryland, Charleston, South Carolina, and Atlanta. At the AJC, he was reporter, editor of the Sunday Perspective section, national editor, and for 20 years, their chief political correspondent. Tom is currently the editor of the Southern Political Report. It's an online publication. And he's senior vice president of their parent company, Insider Advantage, which is a media company. Next to Tom is John. John Helton is senior producer at CNN.com, and he's responsible for programming the site's political gateway page, CNNpolitics.com. In that role, he coordinates coverage of CNN's political reporting staff to extend the depth of the network coverage to an online audience through stories, interactives, streamed video, and John has been at that beat since 2000. He's also served as the U.S. editor, coordinating producer for the afternoon evening shift, and senior producer supervisor the entertainment, science, technology, health, travel, and law sections. Before coming to CNN, John had extensive experience in the newspaper industry, where he worked in both reporting and graphics and design. Sitting next to John is Shelby Highsmith. Shelby is a PhD candidate in mechanical engineering at Georgia Tech, which automatically makes him a little different from the average journalist because he can do math in his head. Shelby is hoping to turn his hobby of new media into a new career in public policy. Shelby dabbled in audio podcasting for a while, looking for serious uses of new media as communications chairman of the Young Democrats of Atlanta. This entry into political YouTubery led Shelby to do some volunteer web work for Joe Biden's presidential campaign in 07. Shelby also contributed to Huffington Post's new off-the-bus citizen journalism project, including some live streaming video from Iowa caucuses. In November, Shelby was selected to be MTV's correspondent and citizen journalist in Georgia and approach their Choose or Lose election section, now called Street 08. On the end, we have James Williams. After working for the state for 9 years and for a software startup company for 6 years, he struck out on his own to explore the worlds of writing and professional poker. As if the world of writing didn't have enough gambling in it. That's true. And so you had politics, and I guess it rounds it out. He's an adrenaline junkie. These two professions have taken him to such exotic places as Tunisia, Atlantic City, New Orleans, and the lovely Eldridge, Alabama. He's the sole writer, editor, and general rabble-rouser on the political blog, Drifting Through the Grift. What I'd like to do is to give each of you just a minute to tell us a little bit about your site, your audience, and kind of, you know, the average number of hits that you get. And then I'll throw a few questions at you. Tom?
You have to go after the CNN guy on the network.
I have to confess to you, in terms of the number of hits, I know we double every periodically over time, but I don't know what our most recent hit count is. It started out kind of low, so it's easy to double it. So I'm the editor of the Southern Political Report, which is an online site, and it's had kind of an interesting evolution, I suppose, and maybe kind of revealing about the way a lot of this is evolving right now. Some of you may know of Hastings Wyman, who started writing Southern Political Report in Washington about 30 years ago. He's a guy who had run a couple of campaigns in South Carolina and worked for the American Petroleum Institute for a long time in Washington, and began to do a political newsletter that had a circulation probably 90% or better on the Hill among congressional staffs, Southern congressmen and so forth, who wanted to know basically politically what was going on back home. A couple of years ago, Southern Political Report was bought by Insider Advantage, which is, as you know, based here in Atlanta, and was founded by Matt Towery and Pierre Howard. It gives us a great kind of bipartisan perspective on things to have a former Republican legislator and a former Democratic lieutenant governor as the founding partners in the company. And we have, over the course of the past couple of years, first gone online and now completely made the transition from being a subscription newsletter kind of thing with one foot in the web to being continuing to have a subscription service that we provide to a small number of subscribers and give them some extra content that can be useful to them. But basically now are a free site that is on the web it depends for its survival on page views, which is why those hit counts, even if I don't know them, are not inconsequential. We, Insider Advantage, has also recently launched another web page called internetnewsagency.com, which is a much more video-driven kind of site, but still aimed at the political niche market. I'll stop there for now.
John?
We launched our new site over the summer. It was kind of a rolling launch that got put off a couple of times just because we're launching new products all the time, and your challenge is to figure out how to use them on the website. So that always gets in the way of trying to cover what's happening at the time. In the past, you know, CNN.com is kind of a general interest news site, but we saw the interest coming in the election and decided to create a freestanding site outside of, you know, for the longest time, CNN.com slash entertainment slash politics slash, it was just another part of the family, but they wanted to give it an identity on its own. And we've gone from being an aggregator, you know, just running AP stories like everyone else did, to using the just wealth of political reporting that we have on the network and getting it online. And it's paid off. I like to think some of it's what we're doing right, but Super Tuesday, we did 97 million page views, which is just phenomenal. That's the most we've done since we relaunched the site in April, you know, kind of redesigned, added some new things, got rid of paid subscription video, which was not a wise idea, and we sucked that up and went back to free like everyone else had done. But I think that also reflects just the incredible interest in this election. You just cannot do enough to, and like I said, we're limited by bodies, you know. We have 100 stories across the desk every day, and we can do 10 or 12 of them, you know, well. And we also do a political ticker, which is like a blog, which is just a quick, you know, 3 and 4 paragraph things that we're getting constantly over the course of the day. Some of them become full stories, some of them just remain things for political junkies. Our challenge is to write things for a mainstream, a general audience. You know, the political junkies in the network's political unit wants to do everything, wants to explain all the arcane little things, you know. I'm so tired of cloture vote, which no one knows what that means, but the cloture vote's coming up. And I didn't know until I started working in politics, to be honest with you. So maybe I'm the best person to translate what the political junkies are interested in to kind of the sensibilities of what a regular reader is interested in.
Did you say 90 million page views?
97.5.
Well, since I can do math in my head, I can just say that my blog gets about the same amount of traffic they get in 1/10 of a second on an average day. But my personal blog is pretty much just where my own network of colleagues come to see what I'm up to lately. What I've been doing in the electronic political world has always been through other venues, so it's just sort of a targets of opportunity thing. From the Young Democrats of Atlanta, where we pretty much went from a non-existent website to, you know, several hundred hits a day. And then I can't really tell you what the pages on the Huffington Post off the bus page, they're in the network of, or in the range of 10,000 page views for each story on a given day. The numbers on MTV's new Choose or Lose website are still being worked out. It's a beta site. My whole career has been about figuring out what works and what doesn't. When I do a political YouTube video, it could only be viewed by the 100 people I know, or it could take off and get, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 70,000 views inside of several days if it gets, well, if it has to do with Mike Rebell. But Grift is much more popular in the blogosphere here. So.
Well, I'll just say that my audience is small but very loyal, and just leave it at that. I started drifting to the Grift about 2 years ago because I had an interest in writing and politics, and it has grown. I won't give you the raw numbers, mainly because the CNN guy just will embarrass me. But I do get people from a broad spectrum across the state of Georgia. There are many legislators that I know personally that read my site. I'm much more of a local or hyper-local outlet. I concentrate primarily on Georgia politics only, dip into the national scene a little bit, but it's mostly commentary on Georgia politics, and I try to throw in as much original reporting as I can. Tom and I cross paths pretty frequently. Usually I'm trying to beat him to a scoop, which is pretty hard to do, since his we should talk about size of Rolodexes. His is probably like this, and I was just But I have a lot of fun with it. It's my personal space to just kind of explore what it's like to write, and Georgia politics has been my home all my life. So I've always been fascinated with it. That's pretty much it.
Well, let me throw out just in general terms the sort of the premise for tonight's topic was how have y'all seen the electronic media or the media that you're in affect the campaign so far?
Well, I could just begin by saying this is kind of an atmospheric thing, but I left the AJC in June and started this job in July, and actually my wife and I went out of the country for a week, and I came back and went to the CNN YouTube debate over in Charleston, South Carolina. And typically in these big presidential debates, if you've never been to one, there are long rows of tables and chairs just like this, and people have generally the organizers, the network, or whoever it is, will have a printed sheet of paper at everybody's place that will identify a person as being so-and-so, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, or so-and-so, the Cleveland Blade Dealer, and so on down the line. And the just to speak of the impact of this year, in that what I've described is kind of the way it would have been typically before, 4 years ago. Those would be the names of newspapers that you would see. This year, you walking down the same rows, it was Politico, Veracifier, my own organization, a number of smaller organizations I've never heard of before. And interestingly enough, even the faces had changed so that Tom Edsel, who you know was with the great political reporter with the Washington Post for many years, was at that debate, but he was representing the Huffington Post. And I think also you look at these debates, the YouTube debates that CNN did, I think in particular, because they not only were a brand name, so to speak, but they were a different kind of debate. But also this week, my favorite reporter from all my years at the AJC, Gene Cummings, was sitting on the panel for the LA debate this past week, but she was there representing Politico as well. So I think that's just one quick way to show you the impact. It's been dramatic.
And speaking of Politico, you can look at the fact that a 21-year-old college student basically started watching the fact that presidential candidates were making YouTube videos starting last fall, the fall of 06, and you know, just sort of putting their message out there in prepackaged blurbs. James Kotecki at Georgetown University started watching them, and he thought, well, I watch a lot of YouTube videos. I'm gonna put on this expert hat because I'm young and I watch YouTube, and I'm going to make my own YouTube videos telling presidential candidates how they would make better YouTube videos. Now, why is James Kotecki an expert? Has he had formal training in videography or communications? No, not really. I think he was a political science major at Georgetown. But he just started doing this regularly, consistently, and voluminously. And before you knew it, you started with the lower tier. Mike Gravel and Ron Paul went to his dorm room and were interviewed on his webcam on YouTube. And then he graduated and got a job at the Politico, now producing their daily summary video news bit, the Playbook TV, and he's at every YouTube debate, he's at the Iowa State Fair, he's all over the place because he just was the first to do something well and consistently, and he said, I'm going to just grab this new medium and tell you what the political candidates aren't doing as well.
I think we're almost in competition with the candidates now too. They now have the means of getting their message out there, where it used to be all advertising or what media coverage they got. Now they're out there with their own sites, doing their own videos, you know, and we've lost the filter of what's true and what's not. If you're only exposed to, I mean, as best we can tell it, if that's all your exposure is, that's how you're informed. And it's, who gets their message out there the best and the loudest. And then there's also the Obama Muslim rumor that's out there all over the place on the net. You're combating that. Things like, you know, it doesn't take anything. It used to be you had to have a printing press or a radio station or a TV station to spread, you know, just disseminate information. And that's no longer true. You can put anything out there. How many times have you heard people say, I saw it on the internet? You know, they didn't say where they saw it on the internet. It was just, used to be I saw it on TV, so it must be true. And now there's a lot of uninformed, misinformed, I guess is a better way of saying it, people out there that just came across, did a Google search and came up with, you know, Barack Obama is a member of Al-Qaeda.
But John, if I could address that for a minute, I would say the flip side of that is there's two sides to that. And I get into this debate a lot about the veracity of things and the credibility of things on the internet. That's a very good point. I don't know how many times I've had somebody in an email tell me about Obama was a Muslim, his mother was an atheist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the minute that gets on a site, you've got dozens of people just popping on there and linking to Snopes. So, I mean, the system starts to self-correct, and anything's going to have lunatics that are, and you're right, I've had four or five people I've had to say no, had to like sit down and bring them off the cliff of the Obama rumor, but there are plenty of people that are willing to be out there to correct that as well.
What that raises a question that I've had is, now with so much volume coming at outlets as well as the public from campaigns, how do you sort through the stuff that you're getting from campaigns? How do you keep from having commenters that are paid political staffers and how do you, as you're running your own sites, work through that, and what advice do you have for viewers to kind of sort through it and figure out what to believe and what not to believe?
Well, I can give an example of that, actually. I went up to Forsyth County about a month ago and attended the Democratic Senate candidates debate. And so I wrote up like a short piece on each one of the candidates and just sort of my impression. And one of the candidates, Rand Knight, pretty soon I was getting overloaded with comments about Rand Knight. And I'm like, this is odd. And pretty soon, other people started coming on and not only accusing it of, well, it was obviously Rand Knight supporters, but they even accused it of being Rand Knight himself, just creating screen name after screen name and so on. The thing is these things are going to happen, but I think the best way to combat them is to expose them to the light of day. And the users of electronic media at this point are savvy to the point where they can spot a fraud. For the most part. I mean, John's right, there's stuff out there that has to be combated. But most of your users that are using blogs, that are using YouTube, that are using these things, they are gonna be able to judge for themselves just based on the way these people act and their habits and their comportment or whatever, that that is not the real deal.
I mean, even on mainstream media sites, every day I go and look at the AJC political blog, and Will Jones, the commenter, keeps telling me that there's this big Catholic conspiracy out there that I haven't seen a red cent from. So I'm curious where that comes from. But in terms of the content of, you know, sort of the organically generated information and the volume of it that is being generated by users, you know, the whole user-generated content tsunami. That's where, you know, James was saying he's a niche blog. That, I think, is one of the best functions that smaller blogs can serve, is, you know, and that's where you can find the most success in that market, is to find a niche. And you, each blogger, has to serve as a filter for certain kinds of content, so that, you know, if you're interested in a topic and you want to know where all the presidential candidates stand on it, you can identify, oh, this guy writes about arms control all the time. Where else are you going to find a source of collated information about arms control? It's not really talked about in any of the debates. Or, you know, Joe Ventures, a blog here in town, that guy writes about all transportation, Beltline, MARTA, the tunnel underground, But you know where to find it. So you just sort of have to find blogs and other websites, sources of information that you've kind of got to verify that you can trust yourself by seeing who's talking about them. Because you may have met James personally at a thing, and then the fact that my blog is on his sidebar is kind of, you know, his way of saying, oh, I know this guy, he's for real too. And just sort of spread out your network of trust that way, and then identify lots of niche markets for very specific information.
We've had to add an entire level of staff just to moderate comments on posts that we didn't foresee how many people would respond to them. It's very labor intensive. The ticker, which was controlled by the political unit, for the longest time, it was poorly copy edited. I mean, they weren't word people. And they had no idea that they would get such a response. And some of the vile things that were posted on there before they got control of it. And then the first debate, the first Republican debate, you know, they innocently put a question up there. Who do you think won the debate? Well, of course, Ron Paul did, because his people are the most website. And then
you want page views? Just put Ron Paul in anything.
Ron Paul got an iPhone with Paris Hilton.
They discovered that we had asked the same question on the Democratic debate and went back, and Ron Paul won the Democratic.
Well, which of the campaigns, from y'all's vantage point, is the most active, the most savvy in using all different forms of media?
Ooh, tough call.
Well, I mean, somebody mentioned Ron Paul, who was in a class by himself, because they must employ powerful search engines in the North Pole or something.
they sit on Technorati all day, just hit refresh with Ron Paul.
It's organic. It's not Ron Paul.
It's quite remarkable. Paul. I mean, if you say anything positive about Ron Paul, you can be assured you'll have an email telling you you're the most insightful, brilliant columnist to come along in ages. And if you let him drop in the poll by 2 points, you will be accused of having betrayed the country and misled the electorate and every kind of terrible thing.
Part of a conspiracy.
So I think he's, and the interesting thing, I saw Rand Paul this past weekend at Georgia Christian Alliance thing, and he was, that subject came up anyway, and he said that his father really isn't all that technologically savvy in any way. It's just that for whatever the reasons, he attracted people who were very web savvy and also extraordinarily energetic. I mean, it goes beyond the web. You can go into little towns in South Carolina, I mean little towns, and they are plastered with Ron Paul yard signs and so forth. You would think that the guy got a 250,000 votes in South Carolina, and he didn't.
Yeah, and I think we have to mention the recent Obama video. Mm-hmm. I would throw Obama in there because his supporters are not quite on the same level as Ron Paul, but he did raise a lot of money last month, and he's starting to raise a lot of money this month. And his donations are apparently coming in very small chunks. And I don't know how many people in here saw the Yes We Can video that was produced by Will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas. But if you were online in any part of the sort of electronic media in the past 2 weeks leading up to Super Tuesday, you could not get away from the thing. And I think that's a trend at the celebrity level like that, and then all the way down to the Ron Paul supporters, is that there's all this free media that's being generated by the supporters because of the access and the ease to the access. I mean, the Ron Paul people are the people that 30 years ago would have been in the basement with the old mimeograph machines, you know, just reeling off the flyers.
I'm glad you mentioned the dip dive thing, because the one aspect of that is that's just as good in its production value as the best music video that's out there now, and it's just extraordinarily well done.
Exactly.
Of course, with the Black Eyed Peas, you know, production quality behind you, that's a little
easier. Yeah, well, yeah, that's exactly.
But even the Obama Girl people, that video was pretty well done. There's slightly lower funded.
Sure, I mean, they're all doing very good stuff. And one of the things that I think is kind of an interesting aspect of this year, something to look at, and I don't exactly know how it's gonna affect the presidential race, but a lot of people, I saw a Stephen King column that he writes, somebody sent me yesterday, and he was speculating about the same thing, that the writer's strike is gonna have an impact on this presidential election, that we can't really guess at just yet. I mean, to some degree, you might say it's already had some impact because Letterman and Leno haven't had writers to generate presidential jokes every day, and maybe that had some residual impact. But one piece of thinking is that maybe this presidential election will become a little bit more theater even than usual, and people will actually kind of tune into it for those reasons. As 3 or 4 weeks ago, I know that the viewership on YouTube since the beginning of the writer's strike was up 17%. And I would assume that it's up much higher than that now. And that's going to come coincident with devices that we'll see before the presidential election year this year that can show video much better. The personal devices that we'll see by Election Day 2008 will be much more compatible with the kind of new culture of short videos and messages sent in that way.
And that would be
very interesting.
I mean, it's true what Shelby says is right. The Black Eyed Peas thing, that was professional level production. But I think the real point there is that they still threw it up on YouTube. And that's where the penetration happened. And it doesn't relate to politics, but just a real quick story. A good buddy of ours, Monty Channel, who is not here tonight because he's out in Jackson, Mississippi, covering the tornadoes for HD News. He and his buddy Mario, decided to go down to the Gen 6 rally and basically do their own stories on it. And Mario pretty much, I think, summed up the sort of new media philosophy of how this stuff works. He said, let's go down there, let's take a bunch of stories and see if somebody will buy it. Hey, if they don't, we'll just throw it all on YouTube. And that's what they did. And now they're out in Tennessee covering for HD News on stuff.
Well, are those, are the candidates and their campaigns strategically using these new outlets, new opportunities? You know, for example, I remember in the governor's race, we had the Wikipedia doctoring big incident, you know, that she ended up, Kathy Cox ended up firing her campaign manager over that. But are we seeing both the sophisticated dirty tricks or the more sophisticated applications beyond what their supporters are doing, but, you know, what are the campaigns doing as a strategy?
Well, I would guess that every campaign that's paying attention has networks set up of their supporters who are active in the blogosphere and things like that. One of the things that I was doing, even a low budget campaign like Joe Biden's, the communication staff had a list of supporters, and when, you know, news would flare up, they would send out talking points to say, just want to let you guys know that this person is, you know, misquoting Joe over here, or let you know that Joe did this really cool thing, and hey, you know, Pervez Musharraf called him, be sure and go to Daily Coast and write about that. So, you know, the candidates would be wise to know, you know, who their supporters are, where they're plugged in, and use us like the Ron Paul Army, but with a little more top-down guidance of, you know, spin control, corrections, and things like that. And during the debates, we were all online and connected by instant messenger watching the debates, and as every answer came out, you know, that there are always these live blogging threads on places like Daily Coast, we would make sure to go over and comment, and if we saw the comments going south and saying, yeah, but Joe Biden is from MBNA, and we would say, aha, but look here, and here's his campaign finance, and this is the totals, and, you know, just you constantly have to do that. And so we had, I don't know, two dozen bloggers working for Joe Biden, so I can't imagine how many people are working for Obama or Hillary. And this is just all volunteer, but just that network of information to make sure that you get your message out, you know, correct damage, correct misinformation, put out the stories if you're not getting news coverage like the second tier people. You have to rely on the other outlets.
And, you know, I joked earlier about the Ron Paul thing about his supporter sitting there just hitting refresh, waiting to see a new blog pop up on his name. But I'm halfway serious. I mean, there's a at least one blogger I know locally that refuses to write his full name out and, like, put dashes in between and whatever just to defeat the armies of the people that Shelby's talking about.
I think it makes it easier to commit dirty tricks, but it also makes it easier to find them now, right? Rather than someone spreading leaflets out in the country somewhere, you know instantly when it's out there and you can instantly respond to it. I mean, everyone's got their truth squads now that respond to these kind of things, so it's for better or worse.
In 92, the war room was basically all TV.
Mm-hmm. And telephone.
Yeah, and now the war rooms are online.
And it remains to be seen how actively any of the candidates are using the next level up, like video. Obviously, they're all putting, you know, pre-produced packages on their YouTube channels. For a while in 2007, you saw some initial sort of organic conversations going on at the behest of our friend from the Politico, James Kentucky. The first person, I think, to take his advice was Dennis Kucinich, because, you know, he wasn't getting any air anywhere. But Kucinich would find these questions, and a journalism professor at CUNY, Jeff Jarvis, he was on YouTube trying to promote this tag called Prez Conference, and he encouraged people to make a YouTube video and ask a question and tag it Prez Conference, and so you could find all the videos tagged Prez Conference. And then Kotecki, Jarvis, all kinds of other people started urging candidates to respond to those. Kucinich did it, Biden did it, I think Tom Tancredo did it, and then that sort of moved more officially into the YouTube spotlight, where YouTube finally said, all right, we're going to have one candidate per week where we'll record an intro video, and supporters or not supporters would record questions to them, and then the candidates could select questions to answer by video. And the blogs sort of graded the candidates on how well they dealt with that. You know, did they screen the hard questions and just answer the fluffy ones? You know, did they actually get down to the meat and potatoes of policy? So that kind of went on for a while in 2007. And I got the impression that after the candidates all went through the YouTube debates, they kind of said, all right, you know, we've given you your answers, enough of the YouTube questions. This is getting tiresome, because then it just kind of died down.
Yeah. Let's kind of open it up.
Yeah. How much is talk radio driving what you guys are seeing in the comments and the back and forth right now? I was coming back from Athens this afternoon, and I was listening to talk radio from Rush Limbaugh to Michael Medved and Gallagher and those guys. And everyone who was calling in, almost by script, was saying that McCain was basically John Kerry's running mate in 2004, and they're putting out, obviously it's the mimeograph version of get this line, so everybody calls into these shows and reads what the campaign is sending out, the spin.
Like we said, we see that. Now the funny thing about the online world as opposed to talk radio is that you don't have to get through a screener, well, at least on some sites, you don't have to get through a screener to correct that. Like I was saying earlier with the Obama is a Muslim thing, the correction of a talking point like that is almost instantaneous. Yeah. and usually pretty vicious. And whereas to sort of get through the filters of a Rush Limbaugh or a Sean Hannity to even have a kind of an open debate about that questionable point is almost impossible. So that's why I think you're seeing much more of the combat moving to online, and the talk radio stuff, which I've listened to that over the past couple of days, it's not as fresh anymore. And I think it's becoming very obvious when that happens. I mean, when you've got five different radio hosts and they're all talking about the same exact thing, and there's no one there to correct it, whereas the online world, do that, somebody's going to correct you pretty fast, just like Shelby was talking about.
And I'm not really sure how much the demographics overlap, or how much the audiences overlap. In reading political blogs, I rarely see chatter about, you know, Sean Hannity said this, or...
Unless you go to a niche blog that's about Sean Hannity.
Yeah. But in terms of general discussion, yeah. and vice versa.
So a lot of your demographics are what?
Pardon?
What's your age? For most of your blogs?
Well, that's why I corrected myself. I'm sure the demographic bleeds across, but I think the audience is a little more insular. You know, the people that are spending all day listening to AM radio aren't trafficking the blogs that I read, and we aren't discussing the AM radio. And I'm not sure that AM radio is really talking about the blogosphere, except to say it's, you know, the source of communism, peril, and death.
Well, John, do you see that on CNN? If a topic gets introduced on the radio, will it show up on a more mainstream, broader site like yours?
If it rises to the level of, the Rush Limbaugh, Laura Ingraham attacking McCain, it was topical at the time, but you don't see that much in comments on posts and stuff like that. You know, but our audience is, maybe you do on Fox. I mean, it's almost like there is a, people that feel that way, I don't think come to us. You know, they, we're not their primary source of, because we're controlled by communists and Hillary Clinton. So they're not. We're working on a story on the I don't want to say questionable, because that's not fair, but if talk radio really has the influence that a lot of people that we've talked to, like in the industry, trade magazines and things like that, and the Observer said that it's kind of a self-perpetuating myth, and they're preaching to the choir. They influence their audience, but their influence doesn't go much beyond. You know, if that was true, Bill Clinton would have never gotten in the White House, and he would have gotten kicked out of the White House, right?
Of course, they had a whole lot to do with his getting into hot water after he got into the White House and that whole gaze in the military thing. But, you know, I mean, something that you said, I think, really kind of comes back to that point that a lot of those calls sounded almost scripted. Well, they sounded scripted. And there's that aspect to the whole talk radio thing, I think, that's kind of becoming clear. You just can't have, six different people of outspoken opinions, and they have word for word the same opinions. It really does seem to be kind of an aspect of this, of just, you know, kind of getting the same circulated talking points now, and very little originality among the people who claim to be personalities on the radio.
Well, I think also what John says, that it's a dedicated audience, and it's the sheep that are going to do what the shepherd tells them to do, and they're not going to question it. So if they send you an email and say, hey, call Rush Limbaugh or Hannity or whomever, Neil Bortz or whatever, get on the air, and we got to get this story out. And if you perpetuate it enough, somebody's going to believe it sooner or later that it was a Kerry McCain ticket in 2004. And I think that's what they were trying to do yesterday and today, especially today. I mean, I was sick of hearing it. To one guy's credit, he quoted the CNN.com. I guess you guys went and pulled out something from 2004 when McCain said he would entertain, because he was reading it. He said CNN.com has this up right now, yes. The report from 2004 where McCain said he would entertain, or he'd have to look at it if he would offer the job as vice president.
Yeah, it's just kind of an innocent quote, right? And I mean, McCain's that kind of guy. He'll just say things without thinking.
Of course. Yeah.
Of course, that brings up another point, and this is where there's a cross-pollination between the media, is that the minutia gets reported, and it gets reported over and over and over again. Because, I mean, just like traditional media, just like television, we're all content providers, and we're trying to get as much content out there as we can. So you go, that's the other thing about the online world. Everything's online now. You go back and you find a quote from, what was that, 4 years ago, and suddenly you've got a story, or you've got a commentary you can write.
And Romney, the video of Romney speeches from years ago, how would that have ever gotten disseminated without the internet?
Well, how about in South Carolina with the who let the dogs out, and that's a nice bling bling you have. I mean,
sure. So if you're thinking about this and listening to the conversation, I mean, if you think about the two people who've broken through are Obama and Huckabee, and he didn't do it through electronic media. It was the Iowa primary and the New Hampshire primary.
No, I would somewhat argue about Obama in that question.
Somewhat, but not, you know, for the most part. And then McCain's not exactly a new media guy. So in Ron Paul, if he tried to do all this stuff, it obviously didn't work.
Yeah, but he pulled 5% in almost every primary on Tuesday.
Not the thing about it.
The point is that in the end, was there really any impact? And it doesn't seem like there is. Now, going forward, could it be different?
I would just tend to differ. There is no old media comparable to the media of 4 years ago. I guess that was my point before. You don't have local newspapers covering presidential campaigns in the way that they did even 4 years ago. So these people are in fact talking to new kinds of media. They're talking to internet news organizations more and more. And even the traditional, if we can call CNN a traditional news media organization, even it is taking on new forms of presenting that information and going out into the internet. I would, in the case of Obama, really challenge that. I mean, I one of the real images that I have from this campaign is an Obama rally in Charleston, South Carolina, where they were holding a raffle for the seats at the very front of the rally. And it was a raffle that was being held among all the people who were both inside the quadrangle at that time and those who were outside waiting in line. And they were doing it by text messaging. The volunteer at the microphone was text messaging the numbers that you were supposed to call in, and they raffled off those numbers that way. That's just a small example, but I think what it is it's an example of, to some degree, I think this is kind of a second generation digital election. The last one was the one where you should have asked the question, did it have any impact or not? It had a big impact on the last one. This one, it's just become kind of part of the fabric. And we don't even talk about Obama leading Clinton now by a considerable margin in fundraising and the advantage that gives him. And a lot of that comes from his superior ability to raise money over the internet.
Right, he broke through in the retail stage. It was a face-to-face, person-to-person operation. He never, you know, it wasn't, if California would have been first, would that have ever happened?
I don't have the numbers, but Obama was able in Iowa to get a lot of young people out. I mean, they allow high school students to vote in Iowa if they're going to turn 18 by the general election. And there were school buses of kids going to the caucuses and voting for Obama. He's tapped into the youth vote. You know, now if he gets the nomination, will the fickle youth vote turn out in November? That's the question. But he's mobilized it enough to be be right there with Clinton step by step. And I think a lot of those small donations are coming from kids that can't afford large donations, but they want to be involved, they want to do something. And again, it's another media savvy demographic. You know, these are kids that grew up with computers, like my kids. I'll sit there and, oh, crap, or whatever. One of my kids will come over and walk off and go back to what they were doing. So that's how they live now.
And you're talking about victory in the margins here. I mean, if Clinton and Obama are still neck and neck, Obama's edge is going to be in the fact that, you know, youth turnout is up, you know, 3, 4, 5 points over 4 years ago in every market, the same way it was up 2 to 3 points over 2000. And he's reaching them through the medium that they watch more than TV and read papers. And if it couldn't be the sole genesis of a successful Ron Paul campaign, it's still the source of, you know, several million dollars, $3.75 million in a single day, and solid single-digit percent support in a lot of primaries, whereas without it, he would have been annihilated. So it may only be worth a few percentage points here and there, a few million dollars here and there, but in a tight race, that could be the margin of victory.
I think you have a point. I think it's, at least at this stage, it's hard to put a metric on. It's hard to quantify, I guess, is a way to put it. We don't really know how all this is affecting everything. I will say this to kind of tag along with what Tom was saying. I think you're right. I think Obama emerges from Iowa as a star. I don't think Obama does what he did Tuesday without the new media support or the electronic media support he had. It's all a combination of things. These are all tools in the toolbox now. Every site has Facebook. Every site, how many candidates were you following on Twitter? Mm-hmm. You know, these are all things that every candidate just has to do, and it's just a margin of who does it better. And like I said, it's hard to quantify this, but $32 million in January, and most of it coming from small donors, that tells me he's having some sort of impact on the electronic side.
And it's also what you're trying to use these media to target. And from all of the stuff we did online for the Young Democrats of Georgia, it wasn't getting new members because we made a cool YouTube video. Getting new people in the door still required face-to-face contact, networking, hey, invite a friend to the next meeting. But what we used the videos and podcasts and fun things like that for was to turn people who come to manuals and have a beer and to people that show up on Saturday morning and knock on doors. So
keeps the level of interest.
Yeah, and when you look at the fact that the key to turnout in a political campaign in terms of online organization is the fact that if I'm a young supporter of a candidate, I don't have to go to some creepy old guy's house down the street to sit around and do a phone banking party. I can get my cell phone out, log into the website, and the campaigns have databases of phone numbers, and it'll just give you a list, and you can make the calls on the script and tick it off and do that kind of work for the campaign. And you may have gotten there because you got an email which had one of Obama's speeches on it that really riled you up, and he said, well, it's this or America's Next Top Model, let's make some phone calls. So it's really just about tipping people who are already your supporters over the edge into becoming activists. That's where I've seen the most success.
There's got to be, I mean, the bottom line is the message and the candidate, right? I mean, Obama represents something to a lot of people. Change, you know, everybody jumped on that. There's all the parallels to Kennedy. You know, people are looking for something different. He's young and energetic. I mean, think of Jack Kennedy back in the early 60s and stuff. It's almost a black version of Jack Kennedy. I mean, it's the same story. A young guy that's telegenic, speaks well, just represents the next generation and stuff. And you know, to an extent, I think that's some of McCain's popularity. You know, he's shown that, you know, he's not tied to the politics of old. He's a consensus builder, willing to reach across. And I think that's what it boils down to. All these things help, but it's the candidate and the message that.
And a lot of it, I mean, some of it, like just speaking of it in terms of the second generational kind of thing, I mean, all we're talking about now is the stuff that's relatively new to us, like Twitter or something like that, you know, that's come along relatively recently. So we don't even think of it in terms of like the emails that Hillary Clinton's campaign sends out, and they've kind of become famous, I think, recently for just sending out just voluminous emails, you know, about how they, you know, won the Hispanic vote in California, or how they were even with Obama and white male votes somewhere else, you know.
During debates.
It's just become a kind of expected, that's not really considered a technological breakthrough anymore, but it is a constant. And yeah, debates are a good example, because the way you watch a debate now is to, you know, hit your BlackBerry relight about every 5 minutes to see, you know, what new messages have come up, and they're moving the transcripts as well as the annotated commentary from the different campaigns on pretty much a constant basis.
So that's, did you get any nuggets at all out of any of this that you can use as a report? anything useful other than just their spin.
I love those transcripts, I got to tell you that.
Those are really useful.
Yes, you know. No, most of it's just, you know, the stuff that comes out of the campaign is just campaign.
Yeah, it's the same things they've been saying. It's a starting point sometimes.
Yeah.
But is it really that much different from, you know, the pre-digital age when you would get stacks of press releases in the mail and...
That aspect of it is, and I don't know.
But now it's they can challenge every word that comes out of their opponent's mouth as they're saying it. Oh, ball or whatever, you know. He said last week that so-and-so. I mean, you can't keep up. There's no way you could read the email and listen to the debate at the same time. It's just impossible.
John Edwards' campaign in the last couple of days just got crazy. I think I was getting an email about every 10 minutes.
I'll take a few more questions.
You were talking about, one of the things that struck me was you were talking about a colleague of yours that went down to the rally and said, well, if we can't sell this, you know, we'll just throw it on YouTube. I'm on the board of the Press Club, and we are working on creating sort of a new media membership category. And one thing we're struggling with is the idea of, you know, how do you determine then, would these folks be considered journalists? Or, you know, I think that's sort of changing these days. You know, a lot of people didn't go to J school, and we're not, you know, it's not that we're trying to be like, oh, you have to have gone to journalism school if you're going to be a journalist. But how
a lot of people that work in media didn't go to
exactly,
journalism
but my point
either.
Sort of is, yeah. See, that's the thing. My point is sort of, you know, how then do you determine, like, would that, and I honestly don't know the answer to this question. You guys are much more. So how then do you determine who's, you know, who is that journalism, or how is journalism, the idea of journalism changing? Is it more news gathering? Would that person be wanting to even be a member of the Atlanta Press Club as a new media member? You know, that kind of thing.
I think I have a very simple answer for you, and without getting into another semantics debate about journalism, the simple answer is apply the same standards to us that you do to yourself. The way that you tell the difference between someone that is really doing a good job is they are following the same journalistic standards that they may not even been trained in. But if they are following, you know, the same standards about sourcing and about, you know, avoiding libel and everything that every day staff writer at the AJC or Creative Levy or wherever follows, then yeah, I would consider them. Now, there's a lot of people that don't. And I think The big thing that we say in our little world is judge us by our content, not the media.
Would you say too that it's the news that you're gathering, or that you're applying the same standards to the things that you're passing along to? I think there's a lot of people out there that just pass things along and stuff.
Sure.
And there's some value in seeing it and all those things for yourself too, or knowing the people that you're having a relationship with, other sites that you're conveying their reporting to.
But you can tell that I think my point here is you can tell the difference very easily in someone that's doing original reporting and someone that is just copying and pasting and you know, passing along other people's work with a few stray comments here and there, and it's out there. You just got to find it.
Yeah, and the other trick would be there may, you know, it'd have to be sort of if you were going to have some kind of application or judge who you were going to let into this new membership level, it would sort of have to be you're going to have to look and do a little scrutiny on it first. And then the sliding scale I would sort of add on top of that is that, you know, bloggers and things, we may not hold to all the same journalistic standards you do. There's the bias. But as long as it's clear, you know, every time I say something this, but, you know, disclaimer, I'm actually working for so-and-so, and here's the downside, I'll tell you that, but I'm going to argue that the upside is, you know, better. That's another sort of clarification you have to look for.
Yeah, that actually brings up an interesting point I better add on to mine, especially if you come look at mine, as I'm not objective. I'm independent, and I'm fair, and I get quotes from across the spectrum because I think pretty much the people that I talk to understand that. But I'm a big believer. I'm a Hunter S. Thompson disciple. I'm a first person writer. I'm going to put myself in the story. So that may be where things get a little tricky and kind of a gray area. But as far as all the other sort of journalistic standards, I follow them as best I can.
Let's. You've been waiting a long time to ask your question.
Yeah, I got a question about where Facebook fits in the electronic media landscape for, you know, the election. Because if you look at, I don't know, if you're familiar with this, but ABC News has a partnership with Facebook, and, you know, there's an ABC News Facebook application. And if you look at the polling information on that versus a national telephone poll, it's like, you know, a seesaw, you know. Hillary's way down and Obama's way up on Facebook, and, you know, it's a little bit different from the actual telephone poll. So how is that affecting the campaign?
Well, everybody has one. Like I said, it's another one of tools in the toolbox, and I forgot the figure, but I saw that, I think it was the Clinton campaign, had a few hundred thousand friends on Facebook, so it's another medium for them to get their message out and things of that nature. Other than that, I don't know how much use there is to
it. I think most polls like that are fun, you know,
yeah.
And that's about it. That poll is not on ABC, I mean, that's a Facebook
that's
poll.
Facebook.
Yeah, ABC
right.
Wouldn't claim anything.
Well, you wouldn't touch it.
And we do, you know, we do this little hokey quick vote on our main page, you know, every day. Unscientific, our polling people hate it, you know. How can you do that? You know, some back, you know, years ago, that was reader interaction. That was the best we could do. And for some reason, that's persisted when everyone just trashes it constantly. I mean, it's like, we'll put one up and somebody will say, well, why are you asking why Frank Sinatra should have a postage stamp? Are you implying that all about Italian Americans are criminals? Or, you know, why wouldn't he? Or, I mean, it's just, we get them constantly. You can't find them. Like I say, I think it might have been something to do with it has an ad on it, and that's probably the only reason that we've kept doing it.
Yeah, it's really primarily just sort of another communication channel, because the Facebook feed, it's a passive propagation of material. That fact that when your friends on Facebook add something to their profile, it shows up as soon as you log into Facebook. Facebook tells you what's been going on in the last few days. Oh, your friend's now dating that guy, and this person got a new job, and this person changed their favorite music, and this person posted a video about Barack Obama. So, That just sort of eliminates the hurdle of people having to forward things actively. Some people, you know, might not want to, I don't forward things because I just feel like I'm imposing. That's why I started blogging in the first place, when my friends were all sending out mass emails of, here's an update on my life, Merry Christmas. I said, well, I'll put it out there. If you want to come find it, come and get it. And with Facebook, it's sort of a bridge between those two levels, where people can say, here's stuff I like, and it automatically gets propagated to their friends. So it just sort of amplifies the echo chamber.
Well, it seems to me that, I mean, a lot of what you've talked about is how these campaigns have all people, used to hear the term astroturf, you know, the artificial grassroots. The question that I would have is, as a consumer of the news, how do I know what is a genuine grassroots movement or just a genuine spontaneous comment from a member of the public, some ordinary Joe, and what is artificial and generated by the campaigns?
That's a tough question.
Mm-hmm. It's like times that when you start seeing enough of it, you know that it's orchestrated or that it's not genuine. But
yeah, but if you see a lot of it, you might think, gee, there are a lot of people that feel that way.
It's. But when it's all the same words or structured the same way, or that's hard. That's, I mean.
But eventually, those, I think, if it's a big enough story, it gets found out. The most famous example I can think of was it Walmart that was like astroturfing some sort of grassroots site?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they set up a whole site that was supposedly this grassroots support of Walmart. Kind of odd to begin with.
Some paid consulting firm.
And it turned out somebody sniffed out it was a paid consulting firm that had set the whole thing up. I mean, the thing was generated straight out of, not out of corporate, but it certainly wasn't, you know, grandma down the street that wanted to talk about how she liked cheap trash bags. So these things do get found out if they get big enough.
And I guess I would say that's kind of where you start going back down to the smaller sites on the network. If you go to someplace like Daily Coast or Red State, and people can create their own diaries and they start putting out a story. You know, there's thousands of people writing diary updates on these sites, and it's just too many to sort through. You know, who's this random screen name, and I don't know if I can trust them. Mm-hmm. So, but whereas, you know, if you've met one of us and you've gotten to know us over a while, you can say, well, you know, he keeps writing about this and he's talking to all these people, or he's got a video where he's gone around and interviewed a bunch of people. And as far as we're concerned, in terms of not peddling crap to you, it's just that our reputation is our name, and vice versa. We have nothing other than the fact that, you know, we consistently do the same thing and are trying to earn your trust as sort of, I don't know, peddlers of small market information. So it's not worth it to us to take a risk at astroturfing something. So somewhere, you know, below the tens of thousands of reader blog, but, you know, more than just a brand new blog spot that's been created yesterday, you've got to find your own network of sources and let them do the filtering for you, because you trust them to do that next level of work now.
And it only takes getting busted one time.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing about the internet is the scarlet letter's there. You get busted one time being dishonest in something like that, you are done forever.
John, I have a question for you in terms of blogs. How much does your staff look at political blogs, and how do you discern sort of what you're going to run with in terms of, not necessarily that you would print something that was on a blog, but just, oh, that's an interesting tidbit, yeah, I'm going to look
story
into that.
Idea. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, we all do to an extent. We have some people in it. You know, there's 200 people in the D.C. Bureau. 150 of them are devoted to politics right now. So there's five of us that do the website. So, yeah, no. I started at 6 this morning and got here late. Right? I mean, we have a tremendous, it's a huge funnel coming in. You know, so we have a lot of people that have the time to sit and read, you know, and we read to be informed, but, you know, it's a starting point, you know, if you see the story enough, if you see it in different places, if it's, there's, you know, we limit it to the ones we trust, more or less, like you guys were talking about, you know, the ones that have dubious contact kind of stay away from. But we also have a lot of people out there, you know, we hope, competing with the blogs, gathering the information ourselves. But it's really, I mean, it's very valuable as far as maybe we cut back on some people like that because somebody's doing our work for us.
I'll be glad to do work for you if you link to me.
Well, that's a growing, you know, I mean, we're doing more and more of that, and it's getting to smaller and smaller outlets. We kind of experimented with doing some local newspapers, just because, and it's kind of the same thing as iReport, it's a step above iReport, but, you know, I mean, it just spreads us so much more. We would have never got the Virginia Tech, the guy outside with the shooter inside, or all the stuff that came from the bridge collapse, and then, yeah, there's also a lot of, you know, man on the street quality that we all used to hate doing those stories, you know. Go find out what this uninformed guy thinks about this subject. We figured it'd spread us a little farther, you know. I mean, we trusted these newspapers, but it got to be too labor intensive to have a story conference, you know, with 30 different newspapers, you know, what do you got going on? Like I said, just kind of, you know, we couldn't have, that was at the beginning of the campaign too, you know, when there were 16 or 18, 19 candidates to follow. It's not as much, it's not worth the investment now to do it. But, you know, at some point it's going to get down to that, and, you know, we'll have smaller niche sites that will, you know, reach out to different outlets at smaller and smaller levels. You know, when I first started at CNN before AOL, we were adding 500 people to the sites, and you know, and this was all planned 6 years ago, and it just, you know, once the merger happened, then they started making cuts. CNN.com lost 60% of its staff. I think the network lost 40%. We lost 60%.
Sure,
that's. Not whining, it's just, you know, some of these things were in the works years ago, and just, you know, we've slowly built back up now to Didn't we have this discussion a few years ago? And now we can do it. But in between, we've introduced a lot of other things that, you know, it's taking resources away. The websites are the growth part of the network. We make more money proportionately. We don't make more money than the network, but we make more money versus our costs and stuff like that. I think that's true anywhere. They cost a lot more to run than we do. We're piggybacking on a lot of their reporting and resources and stuff like that.
I think we've probably got time for one more question.
Tom, you talked about grassroots a moment ago. Is there anything that you see to this high grass current movement with Sam Nunn and David Boren, the meeting they had a couple of weeks ago out in Oklahoma?
Yeah, I think it might lead to some sort of
third party independent candidate, maybe Bloomberg or someone.
I could see how the McCain ascendancy kind of argues for and against that. It in the way that it argues for it is that it brings at least the Republican race looks like it's going to bring it to a closure fairly early. And we've had this has been so intensive and had so many primaries and contests up to this point that it really is hard to sit back and remember we're still in the first week. In the second week of February, so that in a normal election year, it would be another month, or normal even by contemporary standards, would have been another month or so before we would have known who the nominee was going to be. So I guess what I'm saying is that gives a greater, longer period of time for buyer's remorse. And the more buyer's remorse that you begin to see emerge in both parties, the greater chance there might be that by the middle of the summer, some group, and it would be something like this Unity 08 group. I've seen these guys' dog and pony show, and they're fascinating, and they have a lot of interesting points of view. I just don't know if things are going to come together for them this year to make it possible for them to have that kind of a run. I think that's what the fact that that. You get the nominee early on the Republican side argues for it. What argues against it is the possibility of still the possibility, although I mean if you back me against the wall, I would probably put my money on Clinton for the Democratic nomination. But if you had an Obama McCain candidacy, then you would have one candidate who's been in Washington for many years, but he's kind of identified as a maverick and also as someone who can work and has actually gotten brickbats from Sean Hannity and Rush and all these people for working with Democrats. That's one of the things the Unity 08 folks say they want, is somebody who can work with both parties. And of course, Barack Obama, however he may be defined by the middle of August of this coming year, right now, I think in the minds of many of his supporters around America, really does represent a sort of fresh start and somebody, who is coming to Washington with a new point of view and wants to bring disparate groups together. When people talk about Barack Obama being like John Kennedy, but Barack Obama's dad was not the U.S. ambassador to the court of King James.
He shouldn't have had a ministered stamp.
And, you know, didn't want Churchill to throw in the towel to the Nazis right before Dunkirk. But other than that small historical fact, I guess there's some comparison there.
But I think it's got to be a candidate like that where you're voting with your heart rather than, you know, dissatisfaction. And I can't think of anybody out there that could mobilize people behind them. It has to be the most charismatic guy in the world, woman in the world, whatever, and somebody that did that, that represented change. And Sam Nunn, there are people that admire these people, but Sam Nunn is not an outsider.
But if you're putting them up there as change agents against Barack Obama, that's not...
Well, it's like that backdrop after the first, Iowa, when Clinton was out there, Hillary Clinton was out there, Bill with the glum face on his look, and all these old folks standing behind him.
And had Madeline Albright and all that.
In New Hampshire, yeah. Boy, it was nothing but kids behind him.
Just to tag on to what Tom was saying, I've followed Unity 08 for quite a while now, because sort of my niche in the blogosphere is as a moderate. And if I remember correctly, it actually started about 18 months ago, and it started out as a true grassroots thing. I think the first Unity 08 meeting, which I got an invitation to, was in New York, and it was about 20 people in a hotel room, or room about this size. But I think Tom's absolutely right. I think Unity 08 started as sort of a reaction to everybody's gone so crazy one way or the other that we want somebody that can just sit and talk common sense. And the meme, if you will, of the last 2 or 3 weeks has been the swing voters, the independent voters. McCain attracts them, Obama attracts them. So right now, as far as Unity 08, that sort of niche that they were kind of trying to fight for, all the oxygen's been sucked out of it by these candidates. If we had a couple of more polarizing candidates, then maybe a Bloomberg steps in and starts grabbing up some of this infrastructure these guys have built. But right now, no way.
Well, I appreciate Tom, John, Shelby, and James. I think we had interesting comments and great questions from y'all. And now, of course, I know you're going to run home and blog about all of this stuff so we can see what you really thought. But for now, let's give them all a round of applause.